Hello and welcome to Nolan Me, Nolan You, a podcast that celebrates the work of writer-director Christopher Nolan. I'm your host, Emily Murray, and today I'm sharing with you the recording of the very first live episode of the podcast. Last month I hosted a very special screening of Memento at the brilliant indie cinema Cultplex in Manchester, where I currently live. Following the screening, poet and critic Will Stevenson and journalist Leonie Horton joined me on stage to dive into the film, Christopher Nolan, and what we can maybe expect from Oppenheimer. This is a live podcast recording and we did have some tech issues, but I've done my best for the audio. There may just be the odd interruption for me when the recording failed. Anyways, enough of present me, let's head back to Hot Sunday in June and hear what went down at the live recording. Over to you, Past Emily. Hi everyone, I'm Emily and welcome to the first ever live edition of my podcast, Nolan Me, Nolan You. And we have some special guests. We have Leonie Horton and Will Stevenson.
Hello.
Hi.
Do you want to just introduce yourselves, guys?
Yeah, I'm Leonie. I'm a freelance film and culture journalist and I live here in Manchester.
Hi, I'm Will. I'm a poet, a freelance writer and a critic, we'll say, for now. I run a podcast called The Redraft Podcast where we talk to writers about writing.
Cool. And I should have introduced myself, actually. I'm Emily. I'm a full-time film journalist and also big Christopher Nolan fan, hence why I run a dedicated Christopher Nolan podcast. So thanks for the Cultplex for inviting me down. They were like, which film do you want to pick? And I chose Memento because I thought it's kind of underrated. I don't know. I don't think it's spoken about as much as other movies. So talking about his movies, I want to know firstly from you guys, like, what was your first Christopher Nolan film?
I'm trying to remember mine. I don't have like a solid memory, which I know a lot of people do. I think it was probably Batman Begins, I'm assuming so. But I think when I got to the point where I started to think about films in terms of the director, I think Inception was the one that made the biggest hit on me.
Wow, yeah. The Dark Knight was the first one for me, so we share that in common, Emily. Like, and that was not only my first Nolan film, but I think my first introduction to what cinema can be beyond sort of popcorn flicks sort of thing.
Yeah, as Will said, Dark Knight's my favourite Christopher Nolan film, my favourite film. I was very much scared of cinema growing up, and then I got into, like, Batman, Heath Ledger. My dad said, you should go see A Dark Knight. I was like, no, because I hate the cinema. And I did, and it changed everything, hence why I now have a Christopher Nolan podcast. So we are talking about Memento today. So I'm just wondering, like, had you seen it before? How did you rate it? Obviously, this is our first time, I think, the three of us seeing it on the big screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'd seen it before, very, very young, after I watched The Dark Knight, as you do, go and find everything that you can and watch them and watch the director's canon. And then not for a long time, maybe 10 years or so. And then I rewatched it after you invited us to come and do this, and obviously just now, and you see something completely different in that film every single time you watch it, as with a lot of Nolan's works, but in particular in that film, I think it unlocks a different way of looking at the protagonist, a different way of empathizing with everything that's going on screen. So what an experience to rewatch it and see completely different things from it.
Had also seen it. I think it's like a bit of a milestone in every sort of budding film fan. Like, yeah. You eventually arrive at Memento. My dad had a copy of Memento for a really long time and was always like, you should watch this. And I eventually did. And I feel like I'm somewhat a bit more critical of Chris Nolan than the average fan, because I know that The Dark Knight was a gateway for a lot of people into cinema. But I feel like Memento is one of the films where I really understand what he's doing as a director.
Yeah, that's interesting. My dad also showed me Memento. Yeah. So, go dads. I'm just wondering the audience, if this is their first time watching Memento. Yeah, did you like it? Did you guys like it?
Yeah.
Good. It's really interesting. I think the thing that makes it stand out and the first thing I want to talk about is the structure, which is so unique how we have this colour sequence and black and white sequence but told across two different, I suppose, timelines in a way. I'm just wondering what you guys make of the structure and how, is it a gimmick or is it something much more?
It's confusing as hell on your first watching.
Yeah.
I love it. I think it's a sign of experimentation from a young Nolan. To imagine that's his second, that's right, isn't it?
His second feature, yeah.
That's crazy, isn't it? Like, young filmmaker putting that out for your second film and experimenting to that degree is incredible. And I think you see a lot of the techniques that he go on to use, the conflicting timelines that you see in Dunkirk, the black and white, which is obviously coming back in Oppenheimer soon. It's like he's got the whole toolbox out and he's going, yeah, let me play with it all. So it's good fun. I like it a lot.
Yeah, as well. I think that the way Chris experiments with narrative structure is one of my favourite things about him as a filmmaker. I think that having the two separate narratives, like the black and white going forwards, the colour going backwards, I think that we're more susceptible to the black and white because that's how we normally watch film. So I think that's the thing about Chris, he's very good at getting you to go along with an idea. So I think that you believe those things that you see in the black and white, and that's why the ending works so well.
Mm. Yeah, we will unpack the ending later.
Okay.
For me, the structure works because it puts you in Lena's state of mind, because I think it's so hard to tap into it. And I think because the structure is, as you say, well, confusing as hell, because it is, like, let's be honest, it is. I think it helps you, get into his state of mind and sort of see events as he sees it. And helps us understand his condition and also helps keep the mystery going. Because at the end of the day, it is kind of a murder mystery.
I think it's very noir, isn't it? You're following him every step of the beat and you want to know about John G desperately the first time
through.
Desperately. And the two, when the second one gets introduced, the second John, it just blows your mind and you think this is a completely different film than I was expecting.
Yeah, every time there's a new layer. Yeah, I'm just wondering if you've seen a chronological version, because one exists. I think last week actually went viral on Twitter that the Memento, limited edition Memento DVD has like a psychological test you have to pass to unlock the chronological version, which is very Christopher Nolan.
Yes.
Like,
did you plan that to go viral on Twitter? It was like an advertising.
I did, no. maybe it was in the stars, wasn't it?
Hello there, it's me, just dropping in to say the audio failed here, so I had to cut it. We rejoin the conversation as we talk about how rewatchable Memento is.
I still think, because I get what you're saying, but I still think, tell me the Oppenheimer structure, or tell me the Memento structure, I still think I'd appreciate it, though. Like, I always appreciate, I've seen this film so many times because I'm very sad, and I still appreciate it every time I see it. And I'm always like, whoa, so cool.
I think that's like the beauty of like repeat viewings, though, that there's some more to be found every single time you watch
and
it.
And have you found with this one, Leone, more?
Literally every time I watch it, I notice something new that I didn't notice the time before. And I think that's part of the fun of watching it.
Yeah. So I do want to talk a bit about the story, because the structure is obviously very beautiful, but I think the story is just really moving, really emotional, really haunting. I think it stays in your mind. Because I find a critique of Christopher Nolan is that he's quite a cold filmmaker, but I find, all his movies really emotional. Like, Interstellar especially, like, kills me at the end. And I think this one is an emotional story too. It's all about, he's just trying to track down the killer of his dead wife, but also because you're in his brain, you're feeling every heartbeat, every emotion. I'm just wondering what you think about the critique of Nolan as a cold filmmaker.
Yeah, I think people expect him to be a cold filmmaker because he's so like precise, and obviously you can see how much preparation has gone into what he's doing. But no, I also see the emotion, and I see the emotion through the small moments within the film that really unpack the character, like the moment in the film where he's paid a woman to hide his wife's things around the room, just so he can experience a few moments of like not feeling like she's dead, and that's very emotional. It's a very beautiful thing.
I think Memento is at the same time both his coldest film and his most emotional film. The first time through, I think you think, like we were saying earlier, the structure, and that's sort of where your brain is at. You're trying to unpack the narrative in that way. Once you've done that, once you've understood the narrative, and you can then click with Guy Pearce's performance and Carrie Ann Moss as well. Both of them deliver really emotional performances that you almost can't see the first time through, because you're so focused on
just piecing it together.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But when you do understand that, then the things about his wife and the sex worker's role in the story become more understandable, and you empathise with him much more. Also, down to Guy Pearce's performance is really, really strong.
Yeah, I think now's a good time to talk about the performances then. Mm. So Guy Pearce, who I also know best from like Iron Man 2. No, not Iron Man 2, Iron Man 3.
Because
I just think he's really fun in that. And then Carrie-Anne Moss, obviously, of Matrix fame. But I want to shout out Joe Pantoliano, who I know as, I call him Joey Pants because I think the Talking Sopranos podcast call him Joey Pants, and it's just stuck in my head, and now I always see it as Joey Pants, because I think he is, so he's in The Sopranos, he's in The Matrix as well, and he's really good at playing someone slimy, and someone you don't trust, and I think so much attention in this film goes to, and rightfully so, to Guy Pearce and Carrie-Anne Moss's like really tender performances, but I think Joey Pants is great.
He steals it for you.
He steals every movie for me, to be honest.
He's wonderful because he's so OTT. He's not grounded in reality at all, but you just can't help but love him at the same time with the little, the tongue clicks. He's such a memorable performance. He really sticks in your mind. And you hate him as well.
I just don't trust him.
Yeah.
But I don't know also, is that because the Polaroid's telling us not to trust him? When it's in our head. And
Nolan gives us that information whilst also trusting the actor to deliver a performance that's so compelling that we question our lead, we question our protagonist. Why shouldn't we trust him? Is he the good guy? Is he the bad guy? Throughout, we keep on questioning ourselves.
For me, I think Carrie-Anne Moss is the only thing in this movie that sort of ages it a little bit for me. I think you could watch this film at any point and it makes sense at any point in time, but I think because she rose to fame with The Matrix and she has sort of fizzled. I mean, you still see her around, but she has fizzled out somewhat now. I was actually thinking while I was watching it, like, who would play this role now if this was like a contemporary film?
Okay, who would you cast?
I think maybe a Florence Pugh type.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
We want Florence Pugh in every movie, though, right? I mean, Chris Nolan has her in Oppenheimer, so he's like, he agrees with you.
Yeah, she deserves to be there. They should remake it.
Yeah. One thing I found actually watching it with an audience, because I've never watched Memento with an audience before, is it's funny. This film is funny, and I think Joey Pants is what has a lot of humour, but also Guy Pearce, like, the fact that he sort of wakes up in the middle of a memory and he's unsure what he's doing, there is a slight humour about that. Like, he's like, am I drunk? Which is me most Friday nights.
I think that emotion is just elevated when you're in the cinema. I think any film that you admire, once you see it in the cinema, like the humour, the sadness, it's...
Oh, hello there. Me again. This was the last time I'm interrupting because the audio failed. We will now rejoin the conversation talking about Sammy Jankus. I want to know just what you make of the Sammy Jankus element.
It almost works as a short film independently, doesn't it? It's really beautiful, and you can... I think there's a lot going on with his eyes in his performance. He goes to this almost childlike state of innocence every single time, especially in that the final take of the diabetes scene where he inadvertently sends her into the coma. That is a really, really strong performance in the way that you completely see where his wife is coming from and go, how can you leave that room, come back, and then straight back again? And obviously the directing and the cutting there is helping us along with that as well. But yeah, he sells that extremely well, and I would watch that independently of the rest of it as well.
I think that it would kind of, as an audience member, make you feel more understanding of short-term memory loss, because I think that disability in film is something that's never been very recorded very well. So I think that element of the film, I think that you understand more through the sort of lived experience of that character. You understand and can empathise with them more.
Yeah, I think you can empathise with both him and his wife's actions, which is like quite scary and quite emotional. It really haunts me every time I watch this film, the Sammy Jankus story, and that's why the Remember Sammy Jankus is like lives in my brain. I know my friend Lauren's getting a tattoo of that, and now I'm like,
tattoo that, yeah.
I'm like, maybe it should be my first tattoo.
You should get all of them.
Do a whole Guy Pearce.
I'd never go full Pierce.
No. But it's quite, yeah, the Sammy Jankus stuff is really moving. But I think all the films are really moving. It's all about how we can't trust memory. Mm. Do we really know who we are? Like, it opens up all these questions. I'm just wondering what themes and these questions really resonate with you.
The idea of memory is, as someone with ADHD, I find myself doing a lot of that. I have to think about it. Not to the extent of getting tattoos.
Not yet.
But you can absolutely put yourself in the mind of someone who's walked into a room like a sim with a thing on and gone, why am I here? I don't know. I don't remember why I've come in this room. Obviously not to the same extent. But the way that Nolan explores that is really, really personally affecting. He had a really strong research grasp with this as well. And I know that the scientists that he talked to and communicated with very much approved the depiction of the short-term memory loss in the film. So not only does he have it as something that he's adapted from a story his brother's done, it's obviously a personal thing for him and his family. He's got it run by the scientific community as well. And like you were saying earlier, it's quite a realistic depiction of that disability, which you can only imagine is completely debilitating.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of it if any other film has a, except for Finding Nemo.
I was just
I think it's the only
Dory.
Other one.
What is like an unreliable narrator?
No, like someone with short-term memory loss.
Oh, 50 First Dates is a good one.
Wait, I haven't seen that.
Oh, well, but it's like the main one.
Is it?
You should watch that. Yeah, it's like Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore, and Drew Barrymore lives the same day over and over and over again. And then she meets Adam Sandler and he falls in love with her and he wants her to like move on and start a life. But the family want her like to keep her safe from all the horrible stuff that's happened to her.
Mm. But yeah. A different way of exploring that disability, I suppose, in 50 First Dates compared to Memento.
Quite like to see Adam Sandler take the lead role here, though.
I mean, Adam Sandler impressed me in Uncut Gems. Yeah. He's very talented. I just wish he'd stop making crap comedies. Thanks, Adam. Be appreciated. We do want to talk about unreliable narrators because yeah. I love an unreliable narrator in like fiction, books, like all of it, really. What do you make of the character of Leonard?
I think he's probably like, the most prolific unreliable narrator that I can think of in film. I mean, and it really like rings home because who can trust their own mind? Like, and for me, I can see a lot of similarities between this and Scorsese's film Shutter Island.
Mm. Yeah, so I've never seen that before, but yeah.
So Leonardo basically goes through the same kind of experience, and when he gets to the end of the movie, he says, is it better to live as a monster or die as a good man? And I think the same is true here. Like, is it better to believe the delusion and live an okay life, or to accept the consequences and of your actions? Like, I think a lot of people would believe the delusion. I think it's like an everyday life occurrence.
Yeah, I think we'd all make the same choice.
Mm. Yeah,
Leonard does, which is really honest and raw, and I don't think we really get much of that in cinema.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me as well as the German film Run Lola Run, where we see three different outcomes of the same situation, and there's that idea of he's never going to fully get what he desires out of this, so why not just embrace it? And is the same sort of themes of multiple choice and ideas come up in there.
Yeah, I want to know how you feel about the ending, just in general, which it always gets me every time I see it. Like, I'm always like, holy shit. Yes. Like, even though I remember what happens, I'm just still so delighted about how it feels like a satisfying reveal, because I wouldn't have expected it to end that way, if you get me.
Yeah, it is satisfying, but I think there's also an element of like, do I believe it? You know, like,
yeah.
I think that we take the character of Teddy, we take his word for truth because he's a police officer and we just associate truth with police officers in movies, maybe. But if you look at his actions throughout the film and the situation that he's put Lenny in, like, why should I trust what he says is truth? So, I think it's a satisfying ending. And I'm not entirely 100% sure that I believe it.
Yeah, the character of Lenny has basically no agency in the whole film. He's manipulated by everyone that he comes into contact with. So not only is he an unreliable narrator, we also can't trust any of the side characters to deliver him an accurate sort of retelling of events. So, yeah, it does question, do you believe the ending and what he gets told?
I feel like it changes every time I see it. Because you see something, because it's what you see, something new every time. And I always forget how horrible it is, the scene with Natalie where she manipulates him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, which is really, I think, rough to watch. I mean, that, I felt, but I don't know if, again, it's what you were saying, Leonie, earlier about watching things in the cinema makes emotion heightened. Like, it felt even tougher this time watching that
So then I was like, oh, wait, no, I think Teddy is manipulating him at the end. But that's not what I think all the time, exactly. Will.
And again, it depends on whose point of view you're watching the film from. If you watch it from her point, from Natalie's point of view, she comes across like a last seduction, Linda Florentino kind of like femme fatale character who's just using him to get what she wants in life, and she's a badass. But that's not what this film depicts and shows us. We see someone who is using somebody who is fundamentally disabled to just get her own ends. And yeah, we as an audience, most of us, I assume, dislike her for that reason. Mm-hmm. I don't know where your question was, I've forgotten.
I don't know, it's like we're in Memento now. We've just woken up midway through. I think we're just unpacking the ending, weren't we, Will? Yeah.
We're trying our best.
We're trying our best. I was going to say, like, I think there is definitely ambiguity there. Yeah. Do you feel satisfied with an ambiguous ending? My sister refuses it. Like, you know, the end of Inception. Yeah. She's like, was it a dream? I was like, that's the point. It's the question. And she hates it.
This is the thing with Chris Nolan. I think that when you look back on his films, like, because he's so good at getting you to go along. So when you watch it for the first time, you're like, yeah, God, that's so intelligent. But then you look back on them, you're like, like, I'm not sure that I get that, what you're doing. Like, Inception, Interstellar as well, they are brilliant films, but there's just some parts of them where I watch them back and I'm like, how did Matthew McConaughey end up behind the bookcase? Like, so I think the same is true here. Like, this, I think it pulls it off a little bit better, but yeah, I'm always left with like a little itch when I watch a Christopher Nolan
film.
But
a good itch. I think it's a good itch.
Yeah, it's a good itch.
And I think having an ambiguous or like an open ending is really quite something special. But he often disagrees. Like he, with this film I was reading earlier, but he says he finds it, he's puzzled by how audiences don't believe Teddy at the end. And I'm like, but I think it's open for us not to believe him. Like, as the whole Polaroid thing that says don't believe his lies and how slimy Teddy is. So I find it interesting that Christopher Nolan himself says, no, like, you should believe him.
Oh, that's interesting.
You're set up, aren't you, to question everything throughout the whole film. So it is strange that he says right at the end, no, this is definitive, unlike everything else.
Yeah, and I think that you do that much work throughout the film to try and figure things out that you should be able to choose your own ending in a way.
But that raises an interesting point, that do you feel this is a film that you have to, like, work out? Or do you think you can just sort of sit down with several beers and just enjoy it?
Definitely not with several beers. I was struggling with two. No, I think you've got to work at it. I think much the same as, like, any film that's presented out of order. Maybe, again, it's just me, but I have to concentrate. So, like,
yeah, me too. I think your brain just deceives you because you're so used to watching film and, like, this order, like, I sometimes feel myself like slipping out of it, and I'm like, oh, hang on, no, this happened before this. Like, I have to keep reminding myself.
Yeah, well, Tenet destroys Will's brain, then, I guess.
Yeah.
But we haven't been in the cinema for so long. I was not used to thinking that hard. I'm looking at a big screen. Yeah.
I know, I saw it at the BFI IMAX, which is the UK's biggest screen, and I was like, whoa, okay. Yeah. Okay, Chris, wasn't expecting this. But I like that it's, like, because they say it in the film, don't they, that you can't trust your own memory, and, like, you change the colour of cars in your head and you change things all the time in your head. So I think that's why it is really great to have this sort of out of sync, out of order story, because it just reflects our own memory, I suppose.
Telling his story in any other way wouldn't justify the character, it wouldn't justify the narrative choices that he makes. He makes the decision to tell you this film about memory loss and the ambiguity of that, and if he was to present that in a, this is definitively what happens, it would be a disservice to both audience and to the character, I think.
Yeah, I want to know why you guys think this was the one that really made a mark, because we did have Following beforehand, which was a sort of like out of uni mates making it movie. But I also recommend Following if you haven't seen it already, it's really good. But this was the one that really introduced Christopher Nolan to like the world stage. But I'm wondering why you guys think, yeah, it had such an impact.
Yeah, I think it's just got something for everybody. It's got the commercial value of people who just want to go to the cinema and watch something as a piece of entertainment. But then it also appeals to film fans and film critics who want to unpack things, who want to appreciate the artistry of film. I think it's really interesting, like, how close together this came with Fight Club. I think there was like a year apart.
And Brad Pitt was initially slated to play Leonard as well, which I can see.
Like interchangeable almost, and it was only a year apart at the box office, so Brad Pitt was just destined to make like a delusional movie at some point.
Yeah, I think it's due to Bert.
I do love Bert though.
He's a great
character. Yeah, but he's in The Dark Knight as well. He's a corrupt cop.
He is. I'd never realised that.
Nolan always works with the same people.
Of course.
Doesn't he? So.
Do you know, but that's something, because his cast of characters, his cast of regular actors hasn't quite hit its, like, there's no Michael Caine in this. There's no, he hasn't quite found his stride with everybody he continues to work with. Like you said about Carrie-Anne Moss. Mm-hmm. Bring on the Moss urgents for a start.
I was going to say she had it recently with Matrix Combat, Leonie. Yeah. Someone wasn't so a fan of that film.
Well, another thing that plays with time and perspective as well. With this one in particular, though, I think he doesn't rely... Well, we know he doesn't rely on CGI, but there's barely any action here. And what there is really close and personal. The stakes here are one man's set of revenge. But those films succeed. It's the same thing as why John Wick was successful or Taken. People like a revenge story, no matter if it's presented in order or not, I guess.
Yeah, and it's interesting that obviously we're watching this in the build-up to Oppenheimer, which is, you know, a huge budget. He literally creates a nuclear bomb for real. Let's be honest, because again, he doesn't like CGI. But I think Oppenheimer will be a really intimate picture like this one. I'm interested how you guys think this compares to his other work.
Well, I think that you can still see the progression of his ideas from this movie up until Oppenheimer, and it hasn't even come out yet. Like, how Nolan plays with time throughout his, like, all of his movies, even, like, Dunkirk. He gave Hans Zimmer a recording of a ticking clock for him to build the score around.
Yeah, I think it was his own personal pocket watch.
Oh, really? That's cute. And or even the Dark Knight Rises, there's a bomb that's counting down, and it's just in every, like, more in some film it's more like recognizable than in others, but we're on the way to Oppenheimer and the promo is literally a ticking clock, a countdown, and it's in every cinema up and down, like, well, all over. So yeah, I think you can just see the progression of his work as a director, like, as you move along his filmography.
Yeah, I think this film's like a mission statement, and he's gone on to explore it in various ways throughout his filmography. He's interested, clearly, in time and what that does to people, their personal relationships with it, a broader relationship with it. And like I said earlier, he touches on things that he'll bring back throughout his career. The unreliable narrator is something he uses. The idea of multiple perspectives is something that he uses later. Ooh, that was my pint as well.
Oh, Tom.
Sorry, it was empty. but he brings all those things back later on, and it's brilliant. It's like just watching him go, here's everything I'm going to talk about for the next 20 years, distilled into a singular piece of excellent filmmaking.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that this is one I picked. I didn't do it on purpose, but I think because Oppenheimer is his first R-rated film since Memento, which I think will be a 15 in the UK, and also uses black and white, like Memento does. It has the two different. It's kind of spooky that he's gone back to Memento.
He's circled back around. Yeah.
What's the time? Is it? It must be nearly exactly 20 years. What's the difference?
I think it was 20 years, a couple of years ago. Yeah.
So it's clearly it's clearly something that he is fascinated by and continues to be, and those use of perspective. Do you think he'll make a black and white film at some point?
Well, people thought Oppenheimer would be completely black and white when the first trailer was announced, but then it was like, no, there's colour in that. I think he might want to, but, well, Following was all black and white.
I've not seen The Following.
You should watch it.
I should watch it.
Neither have I.
But that was his first feature. So I suppose what you'll mean is, like, in the future, like, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, I think it has to fit his form as a director. It would have to be in service of something and not just as like just because.
I do want to know about how excited you guys are for Oppenheimer. It's just over a month.
Very excited. I feel like I'm gonna feel mildly confused. I feel like I'm gonna be full of tension, and I'm very excited to find out how like the million cast members are going to fit into it, especially Josh from Drake and Josh.
Josh Peck. Josh Peck. To give him his full name, not just Josh from Drake and Josh.
Why is he in that film?
Because everyone's in that film.
Yeah, but that's the one I'm most excited to see.
Yeah, I am absolutely buzzing. Obviously, it's the big showdown versus Barbie. But we've had an amazing year of film so far, and in a year with the Chris Nolan film is obviously something to watch. What will you be watching first?
Or in the Barbenheimer, which is the official title I've given it, the Barbenheimer War. Well, I'm not here on day release.
But you will get back.
But I will come back. So I think people should watch Oppenheimer first and then Barbie as therapy.
To like cheer up after.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it will be necessary. Because Oppenheimer's, we know for a fact, will be depressing.
Mm.
Yeah, I also don't like how they've been pitted against each other.
No.
It's just because they're like aesthetically very different. But I feel like Oppenheimer is the meal and then Barbie's like the dessert.
Yeah. Like Oppenheimer's your main meal.
Yeah.
What would you have as a starter then, Leonie? Because you've only got two courses there.
I don't know. I'm going to have to like...
What's in the middle of those two?
I mean, totally. if you had Spider-Verse, then you've got like the whole spectrum of cinema there.
Does Mission Impossible come out beforehand?
That's 2 weeks before, yeah.
Oh, that's an insane starter, though.
Yeah, because Tom Cruise is mad about
He wouldn't be happy being a starter.
No. And he's also mad that they've taken his IMAX screens away from him. But Tom Cruise had his moment with Top Gun. Let Barbie and Oppenheimer have their moments.
Let Barbie shine.
And Oppenheimer will. Remember what podcast you're on.
No, we're Barbie girlies, actually.
We are Barbie girlies.
I think there's a whole... I know what you mean about it being pitted against each other, because I really like the idea that both films would do really well with quite wide audiences, and I think both would be amazing. And I now think I have a conspiracy theory that it's done on purpose. But they're released on the same day to generate talk and marketing for both movies.
I mean, there is obviously a crossover, but I don't think it's a huge crossover in terms of appeal. Like, apart from, like, I don't know, people who are particularly interested in film, I think you would naturally gravitate to one or the other. I don't think they'll cut into each other too much.
Didn't you say that Greta Gerwig and Chris Nolan are
friends? They're friends. Mm.
So maybe they have orchestrated it to bump the numbers a little bit.
And the studios make loads...
I believe it.
Make themselves loads of money. And also, I think it's interesting what you said there, Will, because... I was talking to my friends about it, and they were saying you underestimate people's need and want to see a bomb. Like, just a bomb go off on the big screen. People will be
That's
there
interesting.
For the explosion.
Do you think people... Yeah, I guess so. We've seen bombs before, though. Bombs are old news.
Yeah, but no bombs like this one.
No bombs like this one.
No. I'm going to open up to audience questions, if we have any, about Memento, Nolan. No pressure. Yes.
So there's a point in Memento when speaking with Natalie, and she's trying to rip up the call of it. He makes a point of saying, oh, you can't rip them, you have to burn them. And then I thought, I was thinking back on that about the whole idea of Sammy, and is Sammy faking this condition? That made me think, well, is this pointing towards, is Leonard also faking this condition? Are there any other examples of that you can think of in that film that might point towards that?
Well, I think in the old people's home, there's a scene where we see Sammy in the old people's home, and for a flicker, it's Leonard. I don't know if you saw that. You did. Good spot. Which I think is similar, but are they one and the same? Which is what you're saying, yeah? What about you guys?
There's that recurring motif that he tells himself both inside the story and when he's talking to the cop as well. He says about memory only being something that is untrustworthy, and he talks about it as part of the Sammy story in the black and white and outside of it. And I think there's that idea of, yeah, he's relating himself to Sammy in that way. I definitely think that, in my opinion, they are one and the same. I think so.
For me, I think it would be through just the performances in general. I think there's a part in the movie where Lenny says that he sees recognition in Sammy's eyes, and I feel like I see recognition in Lenny's eyes, so that would be it for me.
And Leonard says he sees it himself in his own eyes. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting, I think, really blurring of the two characters, which is why the Sammy Janka story is so important. But I don't think I caught that flicker of Leonard replacing Sammy until like my second watch. It is a bit like, to go back to Leonie's favourite, Fight Club, because obviously you see Edward
but
Norton.
But Fight Club was 1999 and this was 2000, so nobody copied anybody's homework.
Maybe they're just like in sync, David Fincher. Yeah. And Any other questions? Yeah.
Something I picked up on this viewing more than others, and it was more an observation than anything, was how memory is very closely linked to sense of self and sense of identity. And at the end, we find out that he's already killed the bad guy, the guy who raped and murdered his wife. So in doing that, he's like, well, where's my reason for living? That was my sense of self and identity, looking for that killer, and now it's been done. So he makes key decisions to make sure that he's got puzzles ahead of him to solve, because he realises that his sense of self and identity is intrinsically linked. So he has to give himself a future, if you like. He realises, well, what's my future now? I don't know what it is. That came across to me really clearly on this week, more than others. Yeah. I think because during the others, I was unpacking other stuff. So it's just an observation more than anything. I don't know what you guys think about that.
No, I just think you're exactly right. And that idea of self-sabotage is something that we all do, isn't it? And he chooses, I suppose, at once in that burning to self-sabotage and completely opposite, to reignite, no pun intended, his sense of purpose in that moment. He can choose then to go either way and to accept a new life. And he could build a new life. He could go to therapy. He could become part, you know, institutionalized and find a way of negotiating life. But he chooses not to. He chooses to continue to be a free man with a sense of purpose, even though he knows he's going around and killing innocent people, because he's likely to become manipulated again by John G. He knows that's a possibility, but he's not frightened of that. He's not frightened to, you know, allow himself not to be a cog in that machine again, I guess.
Yeah, he's quite a selfish character in that way. But
I think one we can all relate to, because I think we all would make that choice. Or most of us at least would make that choice.
Yeah, I think it's easy. I think it comes back again to that question in Shutter Island, like, is it better to live as a monster or to die as a good man? Like, you're going to die as a good man. You want to believe the best of yourself and you want to give yourself purpose. And if there's something that would destroy you as a person, you're probably going to hide from it.
Mm. And I think you're right that he is so concentrated on... Because he always says, I know who I am. I'm Leonard... I'm from San Francisco, which is a line I picked up on this time much more. Like, he thinks he knows who he is.
And that's the information he gives, where he's from. Like, that's such surface level nonsense, isn't it? That's not who you are. No, no. And he doesn't extrapolate on that in any way. He doesn't say, you know, he doesn't even speak about his career. And when the other information that he does give is to do with his career, and he corrects as well and says, I'm not an insurance seller, I'm an insurance investigator. He's tied his sense of purpose to this idea of investigating people. That's his whole sense of self now. San Francisco, investigating people, that's it.
Yeah, we don't even really learn much about his wife,
no.
Which I find quite interesting, because you'd think that's something he'd focus on, maybe.
And when Carrie Ann tells him to close his eyes to picture the memory really clearly, we get visuals of it, but they're quite generic visuals still of a loving couple. We don't see an exploration of key events, 51st dates of their, you know, finding each other or some core memory or their wedding or anything. We just see a life at home, placid, normal. Perhaps in that way that it contrasts so seriously to the investigations that he's doing now.
Do you think it's important then that we don't know much at all about Leonard? All we know is Leonard, San Francisco investigator, because maybe it helps us put ourselves into his shoes and relate to him.
Yeah, definitely. I think that you assume the role of the character. I think that's probably why it's done. So it's a very physical film. You have to live it. You have to go through the lived experience. And I think the less information, the less baggage that you're tied to, the easier it is to be sort of sucked into the film and go along with it and live the experience that he lives.
I think that's also why, as you said earlier, he gets accused of making cold films. Mm. He doesn't always, and actually this is true quite consistently, the same thing really in Tenet. You don't really learn an awful emotional lot about those two lead characters. You just follow them because we are following them, the camera is, and therefore we assume, you know, that these are our protagonists. If you think even of the Joker in The Dark Knight, that idea of multiple choices, he doesn't tend to lean on backstory too much.
No, but I like that. Mm. I like it's a mystery
it's
in a way.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay. You first, yeah.
So you mentioned that the way the structure of the film is made is you get this knowledge piece by piece and you follow along as cluelessly as the main character does.
Mm-hmm.
But I also felt that you mirrored his emotions a lot. Mm-hmm. You got the same frustration that he did in not knowing what's going on. Where are some of the parts in the film that you think you really switched emotion from like one scene to another?
It's an emotional roller coaster. Let me think. I think for me, seeing him commit acts of violence, that kind of sets the tone of him as a character. Like when he punches Carrie-Anne Moss in the face, I'm with him to a certain point, and then I see him commit an act of violence like that, and I'm like, well, how much do I actually care about this character? Like, how invested am I in him? Like, do I even like him as a character?
Yeah, and that's obviously a misogynistic act that he goes through because she's pushing him about his wife as well. Again, we know one thing about this character. He loves his wife, and he's going to do anything in his power to, you know, honour her memory, is what he says. But then he also says that he doesn't care if he's done it because, you know, it will have been done. So to what extent is he just wanting to commit an act of violence as this sort of baseless repercussion for what's happened or what he thinks has happened?
Yeah, and it's not even like she's like the moral character, because she reveals herself to be like not a very nice person as well. So, but I think it's just like where morally I as a viewer sort of cut off in those moments of violence.
Yeah, I think you're right, but you sort of follow his emotions, and I think you do need the violence to remind you of who he actually is and what he's done, which then makes the ending a bit more believable. So it's interesting, because the violence I always find quite shocking.
Yeah, I'm always shocked when he like punches her in the face.
Yeah, that bit. Yeah,
yeah.
It's interesting because talking about memory, I feel like I always erase that from my mind. Because I want to remember Leonard as a good guy, but he's not.
And we only follow him as a good guy because of, I think, the disaster that's happened to him or the accident. You know, he's a rip-off insurance broker. Yeah. Like in his life before the accident, he doesn't do much to justify us following him apart from the accidents and atrocities that have happened to him, which get called out as just a pure act of, you know, accident, don't they? They say the guy's broken because they were there. They had the opportunity to. He's not someone who's involved in a conspiracy, who's involved in something that draw repercussions to him. He's very much a normal guy just going about his business and in a slightly nasty job.
One last question. Was it there? Yeah.
Do you think Lenny was just lucky that John G was the same suit size as him?
I like his suit as well. It's a good suit.
It's nice.
It's very
nice.
Sandy, and I always forget how sort of sandy and sort of, coloured the film is, the Wally Pfister's cinematography.
He's really lucky, because what he's wearing before with the checks,
yeah, like
it's not good. It's not a vibe. He upgrades immensely when he steals that suit. I'm in a car.
Oh, yeah, he steals a Jag, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's doing all right. He's driving off into the sunset, happy as Larry.
Well, thank you both for joining me today. And thank you for the Cultplex as well for hosting us. Where can we see more of your work and more of you online and generally stalk you guys, basically?
Oh, you can find me probably best on Twitter, is where I post all my freelance stuff. But you would have to dig through some memes probably to find it.
But what's your handle, Leonie?
It's just Leonie Harton. I'm very simple.
I am primarily to be found on Instagram. I write poetry. I'm currently writing a weird essay collection about Kanye West and why he broke my heart. I'm at Will Who Writes, and you can come to my poetry night. It is the third Sunday of the month. I've also got about 5 copies left of a book, so if you found me amusing, please buy them. I want them to be out of my house.
What is your book called?
It's called We Are Now Approaching, and you can buy them directly through me on Instagram.
Cool. Thanks, Will. Thanks, Leonie. And a reminder of who I am. I'm at Emily V. Murray on Twitter. Also, please go follow the podcast at Nolan Me, Nolan You. Yes, it is an ABBA reference, not Alan Partridge, I'm afraid. To the Partridge fans in the room, I just love ABBA. I love ABBA puns. But yeah, follow my podcast, follow me on Twitter. I'm going to have a few more episodes, but not to Oppenheimer. I've been a deep dive into Oppenheimer too. And yeah, thanks for joining us today. And thank you guys for joining me.
Thank you very Woo-hoo. Much.
Thank you.
That was the first ever live edition of Nolan Me, Nolan You.
I hope you enjoyed it, and once again a big thank you to Leonie, Will, the Cultplex, and our audience. You'll next be hearing from me once I've seen Oppenheimer, with my review episode dropping very soon. For now, don't forget to subscribe, follow us on Twitter at NolanMeNolanYou, and get in touch too with your thoughts. See you next time!